This is the Children's Hour right here on KUNM, and I'm just super excited to have in the studio with me Dr. Chris Witt. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Katie.
So great to have you. So you are the curator, let me see if I get this right, of the Museum of Southwestern Biology, and as well as an associate professor here at UNM and in biology. And you're a bird man, right?
That's right. I've been bird watching since I was about 9 years old.
Wow.
I first got to participate on a Christmas bird count where I grew up in Philadelphia, and the rest is history. I've just been interested in birds ever since, and I'm really lucky because I get to actually study birds for my job. So professors usually do a lot of different things, and my different thing that I do is I get to do research on birds. I get to do science, and I get to take care of UNM's collection of bird specimens. We have over 40,000 bird specimens at UNM, and we use them for research and teaching.
Are they all birds from this area?
No, only about half of them are from this area. The rest are from all over the world.
Is this a museum people can go into and look at birds, or is this not?
It's not a public museum. Someday, maybe we'll have public displays, but right now, we have scientific research collections, so they're only for use by researchers and students, but people who know about them can ask to go get a behind-the-scenes tour, and we do that.
So now all of our listeners know about
right. Now I'm going to be doing nothing but tours for the rest of the year.
Well, that's okay.
We love to take people in, and I have a whole big group of students who work in this collection who actually are able to give people tours behind the scenes, and you're able to see what an incredible resource we have.
That is so neat. Well, you're here to talk about specifically Grus canadensis. Let's talk about Grus canadensis.
I would call it Grus canadensis, but then there's always disputes about how to pronounce these scientific names. So we have this species here in Albuquerque in the winter called Grus canadensis. Most people know it as the sandhill crane. But what's amazing about it is there's actually a great diversity of cranes, even here in Albuquerque, and few people realize.
Wait, you mean there's more than just sandhill cranes here?
Yeah, well, no.
Well, I know we have whooping crane, right?
Okay, get this. They're all sandhill cranes, but within those sandhill cranes, there are greater sandhill cranes and lesser sandhill cranes, and they both occur in Albuquerque side by side, but not many people know about that.
So wait a second. So when I'm looking at the sandhill cranes that are at the Nature Center, and I see some that are slightly smaller than the others, I should stop assuming those are baby sandhill cranes?
Well, they're really hard to tell apart, the greater and lesser. Okay. The babies are about the same size as adults because they're pretty much full grown by the time they fly south with their parents.
Okay.
So, you know, age is out of the picture.
Oh.
But when you see size differences, could be a couple of things. The males are a little bit bigger than the females, but then there are two populations that winter here together. They come from different places. One is the greater and one is the lesser. I can't remember how much the weight difference is, but I think maybe some of the kids know. Do you guys, Iris and Phoebe, do you remember how much the lesser sandhill crane weighs?
No.
Oh my God! Does anybody want to guess?
I'm going to guess that they weigh 200 pounds.
Okay,
that seems a little high.
Okay.
Okay, no, wait a second. Now that I'm thinking about it, the lesser one. Well, maybe they weigh 50 pounds. Okay, go ahead.
That's a good thing I'm here to fact check, Katie.
What do you think? They weigh 1,000 pounds. No. Wait. Oh, sorry.
Okay,
You
guys are way off. Cranes are. Maybe this is really telling, right? We all think about cranes as these
huge
beasts because you can hear them from so far away, but they're actually much smaller than you think. So the lesser sandhill cranes are about 7 pounds.
Whoa, no way.
That's it. But the
seven?
Well, but most of the ones that are in Albuquerque right in midwinter, they're actually the greater sandhill cranes. And those are about 12 pounds.
That's it. They're all feathers.
But they're the really big ones, the big hulking
ones. Are they all feathers? Is that why? All feathers?
Birds are very, very light for their size. Remember, they have hollow bones.
Bones.
Right.
Oh, Julia has something.
So can the greater...
Oh, wait, sorry. For some reason, that mic is giving me a hard time. Let's try again.
Can the greater...
Nope. Come on over to mic three here. Okay. Sorry about that, folks in listener land. We're having a microphone moment. Yeah, go ahead.
Can the greater and the lesser cranes mix, and mate?
Okay, there's two different things there. They do mix. We see them together in the same flocks during the winter. But they don't mate together. This is the amazing thing. These cranes find their mates on the wintering grounds. You know how they do all those really elaborate dances especially
in late
winter.
So wait, they're fighting their mates like here in Albuquerque?
Yeah, they pair up on the wintering grounds. They choose mates. They watch each other do those displays in the late winter, and they find their mate. But they never mate with the wrong kind. So the greater sandhill cranes always mate with other greater sandhill cranes, and the lessers always mate with other lesser sandhill cranes, even though they mix up in the same flocks during the winter.
Wow.
That's kind of amazing. But it's really important because they actually migrate to different places. So the greater sandhill cranes here are coming from the northern Rocky Mountains, places like Idaho and Montana and southwestern Alberta.
Those are the greater sandhill
cranes.
Those
are the greaters. Those are the
then
big
where
ones.
Where do the lessers come?
Yeah.
Does anybody have a guess?
Canada.
Canadia.
Canadia.
Okay. The lesser sandhill cranes are the subspecies canadensis. They are of Canada, and they come mostly from northern Canada, but also from Alaska and even from Siberia. Some of them actually migrate all the way across the Bering Strait.
From Siberia?
Yeah, into Siberia.
And they're here in Albuquerque?
Yeah. It's amazing.
Wow.
They breed in Siberia, and then they fly across the Bering Strait, over the Rocky Mountains.
Wait a second. They fly all that way. But, you know, I was reading something, and tell me if I'm wrong about this, but I was reading that they can fly up to 500 miles in 9 to 10 hours. Is that really true?
That sounds about right.
That's crazy. But, like, I just want you all to think about when you're taking a road trip in a car.
Yeah.
And Andrew, help me with the math here. If you're going 60 miles an hour on a highway for 10 hours, that's 600, I guess. So they're flying 60 miles an hour, 50 miles an hour in the sky?
Look, I'm not a mathematician. You'll have to get the fractal guy in here to do that calculation.
Okay.
But what I can say is that their efficiency of migration depends on a lot of things, especially the wind and actually the sun. Because sandhill cranes will sometimes they migrate by flapping, but other times they do it by soaring. And if they can take advantage of warm air columns that are rising in places where the sun has heated up the land, then they can gain elevation. And once you gain elevation, then you can just glide down from there. So it's a really efficient way to migrate. Cranes do both types of migration.
They're flying at up to 12,000 feet. And here's what's crazy. Their sound that we hear, which I'm going to play a little of their sound, it can be heard. It can be heard from up to 2 miles away. And go ahead and just play that first one there. Yeah, thanks. Right there. Let's hear it. Okay, so that's just a normal. This is actually recorded in Denali National Park in Alaska. They're just talking? Like, what are they doing when they're making that sound in the sky above our heads 2 miles up? And why are they talking as they fly? Isn't that kind of a poor use of energy?
Well, that's a good question. We don't really know what they're saying, but they have lots of different types of calls. Anyone who's spent time at the Nature Center or at Valle de Oro listening to the crane calls knows that there's a lot of diversity in the way that individual calls sound, and we don't exactly know what they're saying to each other.
So they have a language,
but
these are
signals, right?
Oh, signals.
And scientists have a whole language to describe these signals, but the truth is we don't know exactly what inspires them to call or what their calls mean to other cranes. It has something to do with advertising their presence, and the rest is mystery.
Because in a way, I mean, we have sandhill cranes that come to the field behind our house, and we have coyotes in the field behind our house. And sometimes I can't help but think, stop announcing that you're in the field behind our house because the coyote's going to know you're there. Like, why? What's the story? Why are they calling to each other and they're oblivious to the predators? Or because clearly the predators can hear them calling too.
Definitely.
And they're like, woohoo, dinner.
These signals are definitely for other cranes, right? They're announcing their presence to other cranes. And we know that cranes choose their mates based on the sound of their call and the qualities of that call. There's something very special about cranes that inspired me to want to study them, and that is about their windpipe. So the windpipe, we all have one. It's the tube that connects the lungs up to the mouth or to the beak in the crane. And it's actually a kind of a stiffened tube. It's made of cartilaginous rings, so the same material that you find in your ear and your nose makes up these rings that hold the windpipe open, because it's very important because you have to breathe through it, of course.
Right.
So the windpipe extends from the lungs to the beak, But in the cranes, the windpipe also takes a detour, and it winds up and coils right through the breastbone before it goes on to the beak.
So is that for their call to be so loud? How come that does that? That seems,
exactly.
Is it like a French horn that's twisted, or a trumpet that's got all the twisty things to blast
it's
it louder?
Very much like that. So we know that it affects the quality of the call. And the way that it does that, it has been a mystery for a long time. People used to think that they used the breastbone to actually resonate so that it would make the call louder. Mm-hmm. But that's not true. It turns out that by making that tube longer, any way that you can do it, it affects the quality of the call, which affects the way other cranes perceive the call. And so if the tube is longer, other cranes will believe that crane is larger. So if
and
you
larger
have
larger is better,
and like larger is better for a lot of things.
Well,
that gets back to the coyote that you mentioned, right?
Right.
The cranes have a lot of dangers out there.
Yes.
A lot of things that are going to attack them or their nests. The bigger you are, the better. So when you're selecting a mate, you want the mate that's as large as possible. So for an individual crane, if you manage to get your windpipe longer, you can sound bigger and get a better mate. And so we found that...
Don't try this at home, man.
Yeah, well, you can try it at home. Your parents probably have some tubes of wrapping paper left over from Christmas.
Okay.
You can grab that tube and talk through that tube and see how it changes the quality of your voice. It doesn't
and
just...
And you'll be amazed. All of a sudden, you'll be making a sound kind of like... And it's even though you're not trying to.
Okay, that was not a recording. That was Katie Stone right here in the studio doing a crane.
I can do a crane sound because I have been practicing crane sounds because I actually talk to them when they're flying over. I know my neighbors must love me. But I do. I talk to them. And my daughter can do it too. It's a genetic thing because we too have the twisted windpipe.
Yes, we should get an x-ray. Let's get over to the UNM hospital.
Anna has a question.
I don't know. I may have missed this, but how do you tell the... women and the men apart, or the boy and the girl apart.
And what are they called? They're not called women cranes and men cranes. Oh, we don't know. They're just called male and
female. Male and female.
That's a really good question, because I'm seeing them next to each other. And
besides that, women are slightly... female are slightly smaller.
Okay, in cranes, there are no plumage differences between males and females. That means that the feathers are exactly the same. There's no difference in the color. So really, the only thing that we have to go on is the slight difference in size or the behavior. Of course, if you see them mating, the male goes on top of the female to mate. But if you see a pair together, like especially at close range, like you see them in your yard, Katie, or maybe at the open space right next to the nature center where they come right up to the fence for corn.
Yes.
At places like that.
People should stop doing that, by the way.
Yeah, definitely stop doing that. But since other people are doing it, you can take advantage of the opportunity to see them at close range. And if you see a pair together, that's probably a male and female. And usually you'll be able to notice that one is slightly bigger than the other. And that's how you can tell male from female.
And I also want to point out, I'm always seeing three. So am I seeing mom, dad, baby?
Sometimes you are. Babies are a little bit rare because cranes reproduce very slowly. So usually they're not more than one in out of every 10 cranes or so is a baby from this year. But you can tell by looking for that red patch on the cap of the crane. If a crane does not have that red patch, it's a baby.
Oh, then I am seeing a baby.
Yeah.
And one didn't have it. But you're right about its size. It really was indistinguishable in size.
Yeah, it's the same size.
And who knew they were only 7 pounds? I cannot really get over that. Anyway, Department of Biology.
Associate
professor in the Department of Biology here at the University of New Mexico. We're talking about cranes. And stick with us. In the studio, we're talking cranes with Dr. Chris Witt. He's the curator at the Museum of Southwestern Biology here at the University of New Mexico. And Chris, lots of good questions came in and calls in that little break, including our friend Rick Toller, who, in addition to inviting everyone over to his house to go look at cranes, he recommended that you go to Corrales, to a road called Dixon Road, go all the way to the end, and go north on the ditch, like 100 feet, and he said there are hundreds of cranes there right now. And that's true about the Nature Center, too. Hundreds of cranes at the Nature Center. But get this, if you drive south of Albuquerque, not too far to the Bosque del Apache, they have 30,000 cranes right now. How could that be, Chris?
30,000 is an awful lot. I imagine,
how many are there?
Well, that's a good question. So the greater sandhill cranes... The ones from the northern Rocky Mountains, there's only about 20,000. And the entire population winters in New Mexico. Sometimes they leak over to Arizona. But basically, they're all in New Mexico along the Rio Grande Valley. And there's usually about 8 or 10,000 in the area of Bosque del Apache at any one time.
Oh.
But the lesser Santo cranes, they tend to migrate a little bit further. And they also come and go during the winter. So they can augment those numbers quite a bit.
So they go up and down. And I read that the lesser sandhill cranes actually go all the way to Mexico. How could that be? Really? And you're telling me they come from Siberia?
Yeah.
Do they really go all the way down to Mexico? That's crazy.
These guys are really good at migrating. They can store fat. They can fly really long distances. Well, they have no problem doing that.
Why do they migrate? And why did they pick New Mexico? I mean, what's this migration all about? Why do they leave their beautiful home in Siberia, which must be gorgeous, and have no cars right nearby? And then they come here to Albuquerque, where Anna was telling us how they're right there off the road.
Well, there's lots of scientific, technical explanations for bird migration. But the simplest way to say it is, have you been to Siberia in the winter, Katie?
Not recently. Is it horrible?
I think it's dark and really, really cold. And so I think it only makes sense to migrate, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's terrible in the winter in Siberia.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead, Julia.
Okay. So how old do cranes usually live?
Oh, that's a great question. I think Phoebe knows the answer.
30
or
35 years.
Oh, hey, come to the mic,
get
Phoebe.
Right up to the microphone.
Come up to the mic. Wait, what did you say?
30 or 35 years.
30 or 35 years.
Wow.
Do they really mate for life?
Well, it's kind of like humans, right? They tend to stay together for a long period of time, but sometimes they divorce. So the pairs will stay together for a long time.
Uh-huh.
And if they nest successfully, they're more likely to stay together.
So if they have a bunch of babies, they're more likely to stay together.
Yeah.
But sometimes they split up.
Sometimes they split up or one dies and then they'll remate.
So they will remate if one dies.
Oh, yeah.
Because that always made me so sad, the thought of like some hunter killing a crane that's a mate for a life. And then the poor crane that's the widower or whatever.
Well, we don't really know if they get emotional about the pair bond or not. But
look at the way they dance.
Recover.
Can we talk about that for a moment? Because this is what we see here in New Mexico, is this incredible dance. And if you've never gone and watched the cranes, today's the day. You really need to go look at them. It's going to be a beautiful sunny day. They do this incredible dance that's like, I don't know how to describe it. It's a dance. There's no other way of describing it. And I presume that's something to do with a mate. Sometimes it seems like the whole flock joins in on the dance.
Yeah, the dance is part of the display by which they signal their quality to other cranes. And that's how they get a mate. That's how they keep a mate.
Well, that's definitely how I picked my mate, was how well he danced. Okay, so you, Julia, yes.
About how many different species of cranes are there
in the world?
That's an amazing question. I think Iris knows the answer. Can you get it right up to the microphone and say?
There's 15 species.
15, that's it?
Wow. Do they occur throughout the world, Iris?
Yeah, are they everywhere in the world, Iris?
They're not in Antarctica or South America.
So are they in Africa?
Yeah.
Oh. So they're not necessarily just north of the equator.
No, that's right. They're really throughout the other continents, North America, Europe, Asia, Australia, and Africa. Just not in South America, which is really peculiar because South America is also called the bird continent. It has more bird species than any other continent, and it's the reason why I do a lot of my research in South America.
Wow, how neat. Yeah, Anna.
How many percent of cranes get killed from road accidents?
Airplane accidents? I mean, they're flying so high.
That's a great question. A lot of cranes die when they hit power lines. That's a big source of mortality. And the other source is from hunting or legal hunting or sometimes illegal shooting.
But what's the point of hunting a crane if it's only 7 pounds?
Yeah.
I mean, do people actually eat them when they hunt them?
It's still quite a bit bigger than your average duck, and it's actually quite delicious.
Have you eaten crane?
I have eaten crane, but I have not hunted crane.
Doesn't it taste just like chicken? Let's be honest.
Okay.
Does it taste just like chicken?
No. It's...
Or quail.
Crane is delicious. So I haven't hunted cranes, but I've actually worked with hunters to get cranes that I could study.
So you get them after they've hunted them, and so you can look at their windpipes. Is that right? Because that's your interest.
Exactly. I see. So our New Mexico Department of Game and Fish does an awesome job regulating the crane hunt so that only a few are taken every year, but the hunters who have traditionally taken cranes can keep hunting cranes. And we go out and we ask those hunters, can we have your crane? And we would be willing to fillet out the breast meat for you and give it to you in a Ziploc bag.
Wow.
And then if we do that, would you give us your crane?
You're too nice.
And they always say yes, always, because hunters are really in favor of science. They love the idea that their quarry is contributing to research.
Are we super lucky to, I mean, we are super lucky to have these cranes here come in the winter in New Mexico, but are sandhill cranes that we see here in New Mexico, the greater sandhill crane and the lesser, do they migrate to other places like they do in New Mexico where there's 30,000 of them like we have here?
Yeah.
And are there just a few places or is it pretty widespread?
Yeah, there's just a few places across the country where there are huge concentrations of cranes. And the very biggest one is along the Platte River in Nebraska. That is more than 10 times as big of a concentration of cranes than New Mexico's Rio Grande Valley. And that's especially true in the late winter and early spring when the cranes are starting to move northward and they build up and flock together in the Platte River by the hundreds of thousands.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. Anybody else in the studio have any questions for Dr. Witt about cranes? Oh, we're listening to cranes in the background here, making beautiful sounds. You can hear cranes online. It's easy, just search crane call online. But why go online when here you are in New Mexico where there are some 30,000 cranes for you to observe and several hundred in Albuquerque? I've lived here a really long time, Chris, and I don't remember there being this many cranes that stayed all winter long in Albuquerque. Are they starting to stay further north because it's warmer here? Is that what's going on? Or are they going to go less far south as global warming makes it here? And why here, of all places? Why are they deciding to pick here?
Well, I think it's logical that as the temperatures warm, they're going to stay a little bit further north because they do move around in the winter as the temperature varies. I remember a few years ago, we had that really severe cold snap in the middle of the winter. And at my house, which is away from the Bosque, where we rarely have cranes, in the middle of the night, on one of those very cold nights, there were crane flocks going over heading south. So I know that wherever they were roosting probably just froze over solid and they needed to move further south. But our temperatures are pretty cold this year, but certainly the last week or so. Yeah, as it warms up, they're gonna winter further north. There are a lot of cranes in the San Luis Valley up in southern Colorado, and imagine as we get warmer winters, some of the cranes might stay up in the San Luis Valley.
Dr. Chris Witt is from the Museum of Southwestern Biology. He's the curator of birds, and as well as an associate professor here at the University of New Mexico in the Department of Biology. He's a bird man, and he got that way by watching birds as a kid. So maybe you're a bird watcher.
So I recommend to all the kids out there, you got to try bird watching. Get down to the Rio Grande Nature Center, participate in a Christmas count, get your parents to take you out because bird watching is awesome. And then once you get to college, hopefully you'll go to UNM and you can come and do research on birds in my lab or work with another scientist in our great UNM Department of Biology.
Well, that is pretty cool. You can follow Dr. Witt on Twitter. He's MSB Birds. So if you search for that on Twitter, you can see all kinds of fascinating information that you post quite a bit. Really interesting stuff. And I just want to thank you so much. I've learned so much about sandhill cranes. Thank you very much for being with us on the Children's Hour.
Well, me and my family are longtime listeners, and we're first-time visitors, so thank you for having us.
Well, and also, Phoebe and Iris, I just want to thank you also because you brought a lot of expertise, and those are Chris's daughters, and they're here too. So you are tuning into the Children's Hour. Thank you all for being with us on the Children's Hour.